let's just put some closure on the last hour. Stephen, maybe you know.
I'm hesitant to bring it up because we could be off again and that and yeah. another lecture, so it might be better leaving. I have difficulties with the idea of soul sleep. I know when I dream, I often have a sense of time while I'm sleeping and the bed's going on. So this idea of first sleep and wake up, I'm completely unaware. I don't think it's a very good analogy.
Okay.
We've got the parable of how much you want to get Jesus talking about Lazarus and dies in Luke 15, and talking about the rich man who wanted to go back to all his brothers, and he said, you know, there's a vast gulf, he's dead, he can't go back. So there's a sense that, you know, that to me, my interpretation is talking about the conscious thing that's taking place after people die in the sense of time there. So I don't want to take it too further, you know, than that. So I just, for me, from my understanding of the Bible, is that I think there is a... it's wrapped up as well with the nature of eternal life and the stuff to do, which I know Devin's bringing up as well, in terms of Romans 6, what it means to be our union with Christ, and the fact that we write to Ephesians 2, that we are presently, in a very real spiritual sense, we're raised with Christ in every place, we are with him in every place. What that means, I'm not sure. So, but if there's a kind of termination of death of our existence, almost, which then has to, at some stage, is resurrected, that's not eternal life, there's a suspension of life. But anyway, I'm looking into
if you don't like the idea of sleep, there's another way of doing this. And again, I mean, to be honest, we're speculating on things that we don't have details about. So we have a certain number of things in the scriptures about life. Eternal life, but of course that's the resurrection life. That's the life with the capital L. We get a lot about the resurrection life, but between physical death and the resurrection life, virtually nothing, or some things that we try to piece together from some of the parables and things you mentioned. Okay, so we have, just make a rough timeline, so let's say that's creation and on into the future. And you know, let's say you die here, right? And the return of Christ is there. Another way of looking at this, if we understand ourselves as, say, an information system, one that doesn't have physical weight, okay? When you die, you are immediately put into your future resurrection body. Remember, God exists outside of time. Okay? So rather than thinking of yourself as sleeping, is that self, as it is now embodied in this physical form, is picked up and put in the resurrected body form in the future. Immediately you experience the resurrection with everyone. So we've got different people dying at different points. They're all picked up and put into that future time, so we all ride there together. We're speculating, but that's another way of approaching that. Yeah.
So you're saying that they're in there, heaven is in its intermediate state. The souls in Revelation 4 and 5 are not praising God with the self-conscious awareness of there's been a lapse of time between death and also resurrection body.
I'd say by the time you're here, you're aware of, oh gosh, I don't know. I mean,
they're saying how long they lived, they're crying from out onto the altar,
right,
waiting
right.
for the last judgment.
Okay.
Why is it still a body in grey? Why is the body disappearing?
Do angels exist outside of time?
I think we should draw a line.
No, they're temporal creatures.
Temporal creatures.
Yeah.
They operate in a different dimension to us as well as in the entity.
That's true. That's true.
So angels exist outside of the physical world, yeah. They could be in heaven, some yeah. dimension, in time, they're temporal creatures. Well, so the whole angelic side as well, which goes on.
Yeah.
They can be in our physical world, which we know they think accepted, mixed with spirits.
Yeah.
So they can go back to the spiritual world.
Yeah.
So they can interact between two worlds.
Uh-huh.
They're temporal creatures. Why can't we also? We're told we're going to be with Christ. Where is Christ now? He is in heaven. So why can't the same thing? You know, that's my. It's too pat and too easy to just go back and say, "Oh God, they've got 1,000 years, and God's outside time." See, you've got this picture that you know everyone looks at time at the same point. It's just.
It's a thorny one. What Mackay's trying to do is he's again, I want to emphasize what a countercultural move this whole model is. I mean, you have to remember that, okay, he's writing in the age of B.F. Skinner, where humans are reflex robots, okay? That there's stimulus and response behaviorism. And so, you know, it's essentially, you know, there's a feedback mechanism, and that's all there is.
Yeah.
I left some of the arrows out. You have to remember, I'll just tell you if you remember. There's not just, so we've got feedback here, right? What we have in this model of agency is feed forward.
Yeah.
There's this directed action going in and reaching out into the world. And that's the scandalous idea in Mackay's view, that there is this agency principle. And he's showing you how you don't need something else. He's trying to be parsimonious philosophically, so you don't need the extra thing. I can show you how you can get it, even in a stupid machine control system. So he's trying to undermine the materialist reflex robot behaviorist view. Maybe I should have historically put some of that in from the beginning. So this is not the traditional view of the spirit or the self or the soul, but this is serving a very important philosophical purpose in dealing with the modern mentality about what a person is. So I don't want to get trapped in too much speculation. Maybe I should have said that from the beginning, and maybe I would have warded off some concerns. I do want to move on. Dominic had raised 2 Corinthians 5, where it says, "We are of good courage, I say, and prefer rather to be absent from the body and to be at home with the Lord." I would just say there, I think he means the sort of imperfect body that we have now. But I'll just have to leave that to the side. Anyway, I want to move on to the last talk. I had titled the course, "God is the Interpreter." And so I just want to revisit that idea. I'm going to say some things, maybe repeat some things that I've said in the very first lecture, that I've said along the way. If it sounds like I'm repeating myself, good, because it means you're following exactly what I'm saying. It's not that you're missing something that I'm saying additionally. Yes, I am repeating myself, and I want to repeat some of the same things that I've said all along the way. Try to tie in some of the ideas, historical and philosophical, that I've been after along the way. So, what is our starting point? Our starting point is with God. It's not with man. And the starting point is with the God who's revealed in the Scriptures. And we can look at just a few of his attributes. One of them, of course, is his absolute power. God's absolute power is taught in the Bible, and there's no escaping it and no avoiding it. Now, you talk to most Christians, and they'll say, "Of course I acknowledge God's absolute power." But in practice, you'll find that they don't. They want to put limitations on what God is allowed to do, what he's able to do. You know, he can't do this, or he couldn't do that, because it wouldn't be in keeping with his nature. So you'll quickly find that while some people on the face of it will want to acknowledge God's absolute power, you'll find oftentimes that they're not. And so this is always a good point to look into. And of course, you need to maintain God's absolute knowledge of all things. And when we're talking about absolute knowledge, we have to really mean absolute. Absolute in the most profound sense. His knowledge of a thing, knowledge of, say, this chair, isn't just that he can see it from every angle, walk around it, maybe saw it in half, maybe look at it under a microscope. That is not God's absolute knowledge of the chair. God is the creator of the chair. He knows that thing as a creator knows that chair. And nobody can know it in the way that God knows it, because he knows it as the creator. So he has absolute knowledge of a thing, not just the sum total of all the knowledge we could have of something. That is not absolute knowledge. Another fundamental feature of God's nature is his personality. This is not the God of Aristotle. This is not the unmoved mover. This is not the God that many well-meaning Christian philosophers want to argue for when they argue for theism. Don't argue for theism. That is not a Christian thing to do. We do not worship a theos. We worship Jehovah, Yahweh, the covenant God of heaven and earth. And that God is a personal God. It's the one who has an intimate capacity for intimate relations with us, and even within himself, within the persons in the Trinity. Personality is a fundamental feature of God. When you're talking to people, you must always make sure that this is the kind of God you're talking about. We're not talking about theism in general. And of course, this is not really an attribute, but something, again, main feature that needs to be kept in mind is revelation. How do we know about God? We know about God as we are now in a fallen state by revelation. In fact, Adam knew about God by revelation. He had discourse with God. He knew about God by revelation. God revealed himself to Adam. It's not just the function of sin that requires us to have revelation from God. It's the nature of being a created being. We have these two circles here, God and creation. Without God revealing himself to us, there can be no knowledge of God. And now, especially in the fallen state, where the barrier has been thrown up, and we reject God, who is evident everywhere in the world, we need special revelation given in the scriptures to understand and know who God is. So I'm being dramatic here, but time and time again, you'll talk to people, they'll acknowledge these things, well-meaning Christians, but when you get right down to it, they're denying him at one level or another. And especially on the point of revelation, is they'll want to talk about God being evident in nature, talk a lot about general revelation, but even talk... I won't get into it anymore, but just to keep those main points in mind. That's where I started 6 months ago. I've been trying to keep that as a foundation of my perspective throughout. I just want to bring it back home again. So when we move from God, then we can move to man and his attributes. Attributes of man. The first one you need to remember is the fundamental antithesis. The fundamental antithesis when we talk about man. What antithesis am I talking about? What two opposing principles am I talking about? Just as it says in Romans chapter 9, as Paul quotes it, Jacob I loved, Esau I hated. There are two kinds of people in this world, those who love God and those who hate God. And there is nobody in between. Understand the nature of man, you have to keep this fundamental antithesis in mind. Another thing is the hermeneutical circle. So, hermeneutical circle is that interpretation, that circle of interpretation that we get involved in whenever we try to understand something, whenever we try to know something. Now, typically, we think that a circle is a bad thing in philosophy. If you're arguing in a circle, then you're doing nothing more than trying to pull yourself by your own bootstraps. You're sinking in the bog, and you think that by grabbing on your socks, you're going to get yourself out of the bog. That's typically what's thought about when we talk about a hermeneutical circle. But hermeneutical circle is actually the best thing. It's where you want to be when we're speaking about things on a theological level. My diagrams have their limitations. I think I've realized it more during this course than any other time. I'm not going to stop drawing diagrams. I'll just try to draw them better. So here's another one with the hermeneutical circle. Okay, so the fundamental antithesis. Here is the covenant friend. And this is the covenant enemy. And this is how they understand the world. Well, circles, in my diagram, circle is always the world. And there's something in it and out and so on. So, in the biblical view of reality, we have a circle of interpretation. Our understanding of the world, and we are part of that world. And
we have a complete circle. Why is this complete? It's because God is there at every point informing our understanding of the facts of the world. And it forms a complete circle. And that's, so it's appropriate to have a hermeneutical circle, a circle interpretation. Yes, this thing that I'm saying about this thing here depends on that, which depends on that, which depends on that, and comes all the way in around a circle. Philosophers would say, well, no, that begs the question. You're not answering, you know, you're not answering what was meant to be proven. You need to prove it from something outside of your circle. Why is that good? Look at it in comparison with all other views of reality, where man is not part of the circle, but he's at the center of interpretation. And what happens is, it's a broken circle. It doesn't fit together as a cohesive whole. It's in parts, and it's only, and they only have reference to the man who is offering an interpretation of it. It doesn't form a complete circle. It's inconsistent. So that's the hermeneutical circle, which I've talked about it. There is only one interpretive circle, and that actually forms a complete circle, and that's the Christian view. On the non-Christian view, the facts do not join up, and their only common reference is man, from whom these facts, in quotes, come. So, how does this affect our investigation into the workings of, say, the natural world? I tend to speak a lot about science, but it can have anything to do with where we engage with the world on a daily, ordinary basis. One, we know that the world was made by a wildly creative God. So we should expect novelty and diversity. This is in one of these eras, let's say, okay, in our understanding of the world, is that it was made by a wildly creative God. Second, the world is fallen along with man. The world is now an adversary to us, and we should be wary of its dangers. The world is not our friendly place. In that sense, it's dangerous. It's an adversary. It's trying to undermine our existence. However, also, so another era. So we have a wildly creative God. We have a world is fallen. One of these other eras that are interpreting the facts of reality is that we have a merciful God who restrains the full effects of the fall. He is a merciful God, and the world remains a place built to our benefit. That's how it was built originally. And mercifully, he maintains it a place for our benefit. It has a very anthropocentric character. The world was built for us. It was built for us. Now, of course, that's not a pretext for abusing it. We haven't gone into issues on the environment, but it was a place that was built for us. It's man-made for man, I should say. And this is a very unpopular idea these days, but it is a biblical idea from creation. So those are just three examples. I could probably go on with more. That's all I could think of very late last night. These features will have a profound effect on how we engage with the natural world, and how we engage with one another. Understanding this fundamental antithesis already conditions how we engage with one another. The natural man cannot make sense out of the world without the creation fall redemption framework structuring his thought. He doesn't have a complete circle. We treasure the hermeneutical circle because it's a perfect circle, and it's a solid, consistent, whole circle. And we can look at the consistent life of the God-fearer. Our life is a scandal to the modern mind, but it is the only way of living which is consistent, which does not contradict itself. Let me explain what I mean, okay? So I want to show you... let's see if I have a... Yeah... I don't have much to show. Maybe I should just go back to that picture. Here's what we can say. That we love all people, or at least we should. We love all people, but we also believe that evildoers should be punished. How can we say that? How can a person say that consistently? How can someone say that you love everyone, but you also think that bad people should be punished? Now, most people would say that. Yeah, I like people, you know, I try to be kind and, you know, do my best and be nice to people. Yeah, but I also think that, you know, this person who committed this rape should be punished. Now, a person who's not a Christian doesn't have a system which allows you to hold those two things at the same time.
But our understanding of the world as created by God in a moral universe does. It does. It only makes sense in the Christian system. It can only be maintained here. But if everything is referenced to man and his facts, it doesn't make sense. Here's another thing. The earth is good. It's a good place. It provides food for us. It's beautiful. It smells nice. We want to just run and play in it. The earth is good. Also, the earth causes terrible disasters, tsunamis, earthquakes, all sorts of things. How do we maintain these two things at the same time? It doesn't make sense, except in the Christian view, if we understand the God who's created this earth and we understand the nature of the fall. We can say both of these things, that the earth is good and it's bad at the same time. It makes sense in our system. It doesn't make sense in any other system. We can also say, my life is a wreck. My life is a wreck. And I smile at the future. How can I say these two things? Again, these are statements that everyone would say, okay? Yeah, I'm a mess, but, you know, hey, you know, things are looking up. A person who doesn't have the creation, fall, redemption view of the world cannot say both of these contradictory things at the same time. It won't make sense. It makes sense. Why does it make sense to us? Well, of course, because we know that we're fallen creatures, but we're being renewed by Christ, and that there is going to be a great consummation which will be perfected. We have a story in which these contradictory statements make sense. We can hold these things consistently. A person without the Christian story cannot. Here's another one. Again, I just sort of came up with these, but I'm sure you guys could come up with better ones. I need to put in 100% at work today, but I'm not worried about my job security. Why? Okay, well, we have a responsibility of stewardship and a deep concern about doing enough work, but this is not a concern which makes us worried about being provided for in the future. Now, any ordinary person would ordinary person, I am abstracting, little people are very different, I understand that, would try to say this thing, but wouldn't be able to say this thing, because they don't have a system in which those two statements, which are opposite to one another, can be held together consistently. So our worldview can account for these apparent inconsistencies. Understanding this also reminds us, perhaps, of areas where we are not thinking Christianly enough. I mean, I was thinking about these examples, thinking, well, actually, you know, I'm not thinking very Christianly about some of these things. Yes, I need to put in 100%, and yeah, actually, I do worry about, you know, job security and things like that. And I shouldn't. That's not a Christian way of looking at the world. I have a good father who wants to give good gifts to his children. I don't need to worry. So I was finding myself reminded maybe I should be less judgmental and love people more and so on. So what is the inconsistent life? The inconsistent life of the God-hater. Coming back now to some of the things I've said a lot during the course. We have I just recommended the Van Til reading again, The Intellectual Challenge of the Gospel, which I started you with. I'm going to come back to some of his ideas and explain them. I didn't actually explain that reading very much in the beginning. I'm going to come back and explain some of that now. The inconsistent life of the God-hater has two main principles, as Van Til says, rationalism and irrationalism at the same time, of course, because it's an inconsistent life. Rationalism and irrationalism. So, rationalism is anything that is true must be expressible, let's say, in logical form. Human reason has access to all logical statements. All truths, therefore, are ultimately knowable by man. This is a basic form of way of expressing rationalism. Things can be expressed in logical form, and so therefore I can know them. And a corollary to this is, if a statement is not expressible in logical form, it is not true. So let's test this rationalism. How often does the modern man go beyond what rationality requires? Doesn't he nevertheless speak of ethics and justice? Where is the logic in these? Doesn't he speak of metaphysics, things beyond our seeing, such as the origin of the universe or the purpose of man? On what basis is he justified in talking about them? These things immediately go beyond the mere rational order. So at the same time he's holding to rationalism, he's an irrationalist, for some of those reasons I just said. But the irrationalism takes even more explicit form, such as legislating tolerance. Just think about that. Tolerance is required. Or, the natural world runs according to specifiable laws. Human actions are totally free, purely contingent. Contingency is the rule. Contingency is the rule? This is the kind of irrationalism that Van Til is talking about. So how can you believe that the natural world runs according to laws, but you also believe that everything's up to chance? I mean, what's it going to be? So Van Til sometimes says pure determinism and pure indeterminism at the same time. This is the rationalist dilemma, the modern mentality's dilemma. This is not God's problem. The problem of evil is a problem for the modern mind, not the Christian one. We assert the justice of God, and we have no need to justify his actions. The problem of evil is created in the modern mind. It's not a problem that we have. So we come then between this rationalism and irrationalism, I just call the idol of man. So, if you don't worship the true God, it's not that you stop worshiping. I'm sure you've heard this point before. You worship something else. You worship an idol made in the image of man. And that idol has something like divine attributes. So I'll call it pseudo-omniscience. Okay? Pseudo-omniscience. Something like God's omniscience. Remember, you're built for worshiping. That's how we're made. That's part of our nature. We're built for worshiping. So we're going to try to do it anyway, even though we're trying not to do it. Really hard, we're trying not to do it. We're going to try to do it anyway and build up a God who's going to have pseudo-omniscience. Quote from Van Til. Either modern man will have to admit he knows everything, or else he will have to admit that he knows nothing. The only alternative to this is that he claims both absurdities at the same time. So pseudo-omniscience, he says, well, everything runs according to natural laws. There's the knows everything. Or everything's pure chance. That's the know nothing. He's caught. He's caught in between. The Christian sees knowledge as given by God to man. God holds our minds in knowing as he holds the planets in their turning, or animals in their breathing. These things follow a natural order so that we might be familiar with them and live in a predictable world so that we may be like little gods over this world. That's the Christian view in response to it. So the idol of man is also going to include pseudo-omnipotence. And just kind of taking a version of that quote from Van Til, modern man is either powerless before a deterministic universe or all-powerful as he is free to do what he wills. The only alternative to this is that he claims both absurdities at the same time. And in response, the Christian views man as vice-regent in this world, free as a steward. This was the very nature of the creation of Adam, dominion over the creatures. He's like a little god. He's like a little king, in the image of the great God, the great king, over the entire universe. He has this domain, but he has it freely, but he has it as a steward to care for it. Also, even pseudo-personality. On what basis do we ascribe personality to one another as if it is something different from our physical being? How do we recognize if we are not viewing the world according to the creation, fall, redemption story, which the scriptures teach us, where do we get personality from? I mean, you know, we're basically just a reflex robot machine. Where is our justification for identifying personality in people? Where does that come from? It's not included in our system, but we allow it in. We have a sort of pseudo-personality in the God that we worship, which is man. But of course, we have an explanation for personality. It's the image of God. God is, remember I said at the beginning, one of his fundamental attributes is his personality, and we have it in virtue of being made in his image. So, the modern view includes rationalism, which I've said enough about, mechanism, which I've said quite a lot about in this course. And Christian theology, particularly Reformed theology, is the perspective I've been speaking from, responds in terms which scandalize both rationalism and mechanism. So, in order to show how the Christian worldview, if I haven't shown it yet, scandalizes these things, it's helpful to look at the Christian view of Christian things and then I'll come back to the Christian view of everything. So let's just look at some theological principles first to see how Christians understand theology and apply some of that to our understanding of everything else. So there's, of course, the Trinity, which David had reminded us about, where we have three and one. Okay, now the traditional Orthodox confessions of the Christian faith speak about the Trinity in terms of three in one. This is, I would say, a rationalist dodge. It's true. God is three in one. He is three persons in one substance. That's absolutely true. But I think we can say a little bit more. We can say a little bit more if your ears can stand it. God is three and one. He's three and one. We'll just leave that at that. Predestination and free will. This is an impossible contradiction according to rationalism and mechanism, which I spoke about in talking about theodicy and Leibniz. It's an impossible contradiction according to rationalism and mechanism. The mechanical causal order creates a problem. We can't have predestination and free will. It's either caused by God or it's caused by something else. We can't have these two together. This is not only possible in the Christian view of God and man, but the only reasonable view of matters. Rationalism and mechanism are only secondary orders of things. God is the ultimate order of all things. He makes them go. No natural or logical law or rule governs his actions. He acts with absolute freedom. He is the ultimate principle of the world. How many other ways can I say this? Can he not order all things such that our free actions follow his predestination? Are we going to limit the nature of God? Remember, absolute power. I mean it. I really mean it. Absolute power. What is it that you say that binds the possibility of God? You judge God on rationalist or mechanist standards only because you have first rejected him. Predestination, free will. The sacraments, too. I'm going to tread on hallowed ground here, but let's just go with this one. Everywhere in Christian theology, you find places where both rationalism and mechanism are inadequate to understand and articulate even the most basic doctrines. I want to use the sacraments as an example because it's the really religious part of religion in some ways for some people. It really comes down to earth because the sacraments is a very real encounter between God and man in worship. So we look at baptism. How is it that baptism, a command from God, is able to be a benefit to us? What is the causal relation, we might ask, between baptism and the blessing promised? Well, in the Roman Catholic tradition, the blessing is in the thing itself. And we get the view of baptismal regeneration. In the Baptist view, the blessing is in the intention of the partaker. And you have a believer's baptism. In both cases, the rational mind must find it in one or the other aspect. When I think the true view of baptism is includes both. The Lord's Supper. How is it that the Lord's Supper, a command from God, is able to be a benefit to us? What is the causal relation, we might ask, between the Lord's Supper and the blessing promised? Again, in the Roman Catholic view, the blessing is in the thing itself. That's where the reality of it is. And you have transubstantiation. On the opposite extreme, you have the memorialist view. The blessing is in the intention of the partaker. In both sacraments, there is a reality, but a reality not fully described by things present. Okay? It's a reality not fully described by things present, whether it's in the substance of the things that are doing it or the intentions of the person who's doing it. It's not in either one of those places. It's in both places. Isaiah 57:15. Fairly well-known passage, I think. For thus says the high and exalted one who lives forever, whose name is holy, I dwell on a high and holy place, and also with the contrite and lowly of spirit. And also with the contrite, in Isaiah 57:15. These two opposites are brought together in Christian experience, in Christian theology. So we take this now, this Christian view of Christian things, and we apply this to our Christian view of everything. Okay, maybe what we were talking about, the body and the soul and the spirit, maybe you'll be happier with things coming together this way now. Take the Christian view of Christian things, these principles of theology, three in one, predestination and free will, the nature of the sacraments, the real presence, and all this going on, and apply this to the Christian view of everything. The rules of interpretation don't change when you move from talking about the things of God to other things. Everything is a thing of God. It all belongs to Him. Okay? So when we come up against these difficult oppositions in Christian theology, and then when we come up to oppositions in our understanding of the natural world, whether it's brain and mind or causation and determinacy, why should the rules change? Because it's still God's world. Just because we're not talking about theology doesn't mean God isn't anymore, is no longer over all things. So, just to close now, the course has been about engaging with modern ideas, philosophy, particularly the emphasis of science in the last 400 years. What's the situation that we have? Do we have something in the modern age that's particularly difficult? Let me try to put it in very simple biblical perspective. The original situation was the fall. The original situation, that is, a situation of confrontation between God's people and the forces of darkness. The original situation is the fall, where we had this order of God, man, woman, beast. Okay, Satan in the order of the beast in the fall story. God, man, woman, beast. That order was turned upside down. All right? The woman listened to the beast, the man listened to the woman, and did not listen to God. The order was turned upside down. The modern situation, it's essentially the same. It's essentially the same. We have this beast, woman, man, God equals natural laws in the order of the beast. The physical order is now, natural laws are put at the top. Then comes man, rationalism. And then God, well, that's an artifact of history. He's been historicized, you could say. So looking at it in those terms, not to demean the various challenges of understanding human culture and history and philosophy during the modern period. But, I mean, the world will continue to change around you. The world will change, but these facts will remain the same. The grass withers and the flower fades, but the word of our God stands forever. Questions? I guess I didn't need that. Well, that's a change. Yeah, go ahead. I'm just going to sit down.
It looks fantastic how you're finishing, really. If I can sit in this back onto how amazing our God is. Without wanting to revisit earlier discussions too much, I wonder whether we also need to. There seems to be a contrast between your two lectures.
Okay.
I was wondering whether it might be possible to kind of bring a bit of what you were saying in the last lecture into your first lecture.
What are you thinking of in particular?
I feel the whole universe is like the Trinity of predestination, free will, the sacraments.
Uh-huh.
And that's certainly what we learn from science. So I'm just feeling this needs to be that same kind of feel, however you want to resolve some of the dilemmas. I feel we need more of that antinomy sense in our model of human beings. That purely, this is a rationalized, a cleaned up rationalized version. I think it's the problem also in the creation evolution issue as well. Different parties are presenting a cleaned up rationalized view, when actually the nature of reality is this strange.
And you'll be taking the task if you try to use it, you know. That's why you need a theology that makes that possible. Okay, remember the Kant talks now, the transcendental arguments, the condition for the possibility of dot, dot, dot. The Christian theology is the condition for the possibility of any complete understanding of the world. That's why I have a solid circle on the left there and a sketchy circle on the right. It's going to provide you the only system. And on the most, in the most ultimate sense.
Yeah, and we need some principles to determine when to admit there's a mystery or an apparent contradiction.
Yeah.
So I was reading recently of some more modern theologian, maybe it was Boltzmann or someone, who'd gone beyond sort of the acceptance of propositions that are true or false to say anything's both true and false. And I could almost see him saying, oh yeah, because that's the mystery of the divine. Yeah. But then that's taking it too far.
No, that's paralyzing. Yeah.
So surely we have to have some kind of lines drawn.
Yeah. Well, okay, so we have to deal with it one question at a time. And I happen to have that one up there. So what Mackay's trying to do is he's trying to bring those two together. He wants to show you how the Christian conception of the soul or spirit or even mind fits together rationally with the mechanical view of the brain. So he doesn't want to just say, both are true and it's a mystery how it's done. He's doing his best to try to articulate how these two things are actually consistent. And so that's the hard work of being a Christian living in the world, is wherever area happens to be your domain, is to do your best to articulate to people, or for yourself, for the public, how these opposing principles are in fact working together. Yeah, it is unsatisfying to just say it's mystery. It's like a version of the God of the Gaps argument, which we all, want to avoid, like the plague. Because it doesn't do anything. In fact, it seems to do more harm than good.
Another example is your proposition about God. God is absolutely powerful.
Mm-hmm.
It's true, obviously. But some people I could see extending that to say, because God can do anything, he has done everything.
Uh-huh.
And therefore, God, our God, is the same as the God of Buddha or anything else. But it is true that God has chosen to do only certain things. You cannot use that statement to there are some limits that are set in the Bible about what God is like. And what is
That's why I included Revelation as one of those fundamental things, because that breaks through the possibility of everything or the identity of Yahweh with any other God.
Yeah.
And no other God gives you this circle, because it doesn't have a creation, fall, redemption story, which is fundamental to making sense of the whole universe.
Isn't the test that we have to come back to scripture itself that sort of defines where these antinomies lie?
Yes. I mean, Revelation, preeminently special revelation.
I think looking at the whole subject of the last six sessions, the way I describe it is that there's a huge plausibility problem for the modern mind because of science that didn't exist for people before. Most people just accepted either a God exists or that gods exist, proved obvious, this universe didn't govern itself. And so what has created the dilemma for us is this mechanistic view of the reality, which has been spawned by science. I don't think it's true science.
But would you say it's kind of full circle? That we actually come back, as we've to a point now, it seems to me, where science has discovered so much, it suddenly, if you like, discovered too much, because it can no longer explain it the way. It's now to confront the fact that, well, hang on, the simple ideas that we have, we can explain everything away without God, we actually can't anymore, because the more we've discovered that there is design and all the rest of it, that we actually are confronted with even bigger problems than we had 200, 300 years ago, that they're being forced back. It seems to me a lot of what I've read of secular scientists are actually starting to say, hang on, the way we used to think was just too simple, because the evidence is pointing us away from a material materialistic universe, and there's something else there. There is all this evidence of design and all those two. So it seems to me we're God, in very clever ways, allowed man to discover all these things, and only to undo himself in his own cleverness. And God said, go ahead, you know, you think you're so clever, only to man blindly not realising where he was going, that God's leading down his path.
Or drawing back to himself.
And God saying, you've got to be checking all these ways through science, to only lead one way. No matter which way, with the lead back one way, eventually, and you discover all this that comes back to God. And I think that's teaching me really.
I think to be fair to what Jason has been saying, though, is first that you perhaps are leaning away from a rationalistic, materialistic, reductionistic view of the world, back perhaps to another animistic one, not necessarily Christian view.
A man in his fullness will. Confronted with that, has to look for something else.
Right.
Because he can't. He tries for the evidence, doesn't like it, he has to try and explain. So, Cricket says there's spacemen sent, you know, brought to say, you know, rather than face the truth. That's true.
Morales comment, but it's not real science. It makes me think that some like theory of evolution has been put forward as fact, but it isn't. And science isn't really the knowing of what scientists think it is. Mm-hmm. So, there's again another illusion. Mm-hmm. And Einstein, I believe, because I read it, was converted. Mm-hmm. Because as he just saw a picture, I mean, I don't know if he was visionary, but he saw the knowledge that he had, which is increasing like a balloon. And he suddenly realized that the greater the volume of knowledge, the bigger his balloon of knowledge, the larger was the surface area in contact with the known outside that. And he became a believing Jew. He believed in God. As a result of recognizing, he brought him to his knees, which is the business of man ever knowing and never coming to a knowledge. The origin of the universe, the final particle of the atom, and all these things that we're talking about. It's the coming to the humility that we cannot, with our finite minds, know everything. We can know a lot. There was Newton exploring the nature of God's universe, but it comes back to the early morning. What is our platform?
Yeah. Just your comment on that.
The greatest thing I've taken away from this whole course is a help in apologetics. The utter futility of life without God. You can talk about the details, but ultimately mankind is trying to distract himself or herself with all sorts of entertainments, and the more that the materialistic scientific approach proceeds, Alan Dawkins, the more in parallel mankind has to hide behind distractions, otherwise the exposure to that is completely sparing, yes. So to remind people to take away all of that entertainment and distraction and say, look, this is actually the consequences. That's a futility. I think that's one of the most powerful messages.
Ecclesiastic.
Chasing after them.
Jason, I remember asking you, I think it was in the first lecture, as you were talking about the attributes of God and being God.
Yeah.
You didn't use the word love. I'm not obsessive with that, because you use many other words today about mercy and goodness and that. Mm-hmm. But you were, I think, designedly avoiding using that word. And you you said by the end of the course, you said you would see why I did that. I'm not holding you to that. That's what you said. And
what did I promise again?
I'm sorry.
I remember the occasion.
Pulled over the colours.
What did I promise?
You said you did it you deliberately avoided using that word, and it was in the context of the course and your goals and intentions and what you were trying to. And I trusted you then. I trusted you then. I think I can see a bit more feeling maybe why. But I just wondered if you wanted to open your mind and heart to us.
I think in
conclusion, as it were.
If I can hazily remember, I do remember your question. I think I remember what I said then. Of course, the aims of the course are limited. It is a finite scope. And I think something of what I said at the time was that the problems of human suffering are problems of every age, and certainly not unique to the modern period. And so what I was going to try to talk about were some of the things that might be unique to the modern period, although at the end I suggested they weren't that unique. But the language in which the travail of sin is articulated in the modern period. And in addressing those things, it's been helpful to emphasize these certain attributes of God in addressing rationalism and mechanism. Rather than addressing love in particular, which I think is one of God's attributes, which is easily applicable to all ages of humanity in addressing the suffering which we suffer under sin. I think that's kind of what I said then, and I think I'm sticking by that now as I've tried to articulate historically, philosophically, what kind of ideologies we've been dealing with. Practically speaking, when you talk to people, not everybody cares what Descartes thought. And not everybody cares what Dawkins thinks either. They care about, how they're going to pay their bills and their kids in the hospital because they've got leukemia and frankly, a message of hope and divine care, love, is easily far more appropriate in those situations. So, this is not a panacea for all apologetic situations, but might help in addressing quite a lot of people, and I won't even say it's limited to educated people. I mean, we all live in a modern world that our intuitions are mechanical ones. All of us, however religious we are, in this country and most of the ones within a 2,000-mile radius of us, our intuitions are mechanical ones. So it does help in a lot of situations. It does help in medical situations. We're inclined to think of things as being part of a deterministic universe. Then we do have something to say about God's purposes of redemption. So,
Jason, it puts me in mind of something which comes in Shakespeare's book, The God Is There. A young couple were in Paris, and they'd fallen in love. And then they were trying to place love within this impersonal universe, and realized they were absolutely stuck. And it was this that then finally led them to think more seriously about the metaphysical. In other words, to question the whole of the mechanistic view. So I think I don't know quite where Jason is going with that idea of the the culture in which we live being one which has been so seriously influenced by science that mechanistic ideas predominate. But I think we have a wonderful entree at that point, just like with this young couple, to immediately draw attention to the inconsistency. And I think you were saying this, weren't you, Jason, earlier, the irrationalism of, on the one hand, saying it is just a purely mechanistic universe, and then falling in love, you know, it just doesn't square. So it seems to me I would just affirm strongly as number one the fact that we live in a personal universe,
yeah,
and that therefore love is central, because, and that's why the Bible only has two, as were definitions of God, which are simple. One is God is love, and then the other one, God is holy, or God is morally perfect. Okay, that's how I understand. And that way completely separate from the few symbols. But it seems to me we don't need to wait and go through some sort of big philosophical discussion about the mechanism of the universe. If the issue presents itself, and I think we can present it to people, you know, very early on. My wife did it just yesterday with a fellow who's older, he's living in our retirement complex, and we've had many discussions, and he's a thoroughgoing atheist. And he, you know, laughs at us periodically. And now his daughter's got it, and his granddaughter's got it, the most awful disease in which the skin falls off your body. I don't even, you know what it's called, but has had to go to a great ormond street. So Susan's walking along with him, and then can sort of immediately penetrate to the meaninglessness of this whole experience for him, which then implies that his own experience is meaningless. To have his daughter, his granddaughter, whom he loved, you know, thrown into this kind of horrible situation. So Susan then just talks about those things in relation to the God that's actually there, and that there is real love, there is real. So the way she put it was that there's a difference between, because he thought, well, what you're trying to say to me is if you've got faith, then you're going to be more able to handle this sort of situation. And she was saying, no, this is really true. Human beings really are made in the image of God, and they really are creatures. And I think that made an impression on him. But I'm not quite sure what you're looking for, because I think if what you're looking for is the idea of the gospel coming in, and that God is love and that he has saved us in Christ, it seems to me, with this implausibility problem that people have, you do need to try to help them see that actually their own mechanistic view just doesn't make any sense. You can approach that in a number of different ways.
My original query was, as Jason presented, I think it was the theology of God, basically.
Yeah.
And so it wasn't so much even to do with how it was apologetics,
okay,
but
yeah,
it was on that point.
Why did I choose the
But then you said you had a point, and you explained the point, so I'm satisfied.
I mean, as I'm listening and looking at my diagram up there, I think I'm recognizing, too, that there's an intensely personal element to how I look at all this stuff. I mean, I became a Christian around age 17, and the way that it went through my mind in that process was here's where I was, and I thought that I was in control of everything in my life, and that I was not only the interpreter, but the director of events in my life. Of course, God used a variety of circumstances to teach me, one, that I didn't have control over my performance in certain areas, that I didn't have control over my emotions about certain things, and bit by bit, well, there were other things going on too, bit by bit I was recognizing this whole thing came crashing down.
Mm-hmm.
So, let's be recorded now. I don't know how much of this whole course is just a function of the way I see man in the universe as a Christian, and how much of it's a good way of looking at the modern world. It just could be my angle. I don't know. So there's that element too. I have to confess, it's probably in there somewhere, although I'm not exactly sure.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. So maybe when you teach it to the church or whoever, you might have a different way of, sure, of doing it.
Jason,
yeah.
May I comfort you? It sounds patronizing. I don't intend it. Mm-hmm. Everybody has their angle.
Yeah.
They're all grasped by God. It says, if as you have received Christ,
yeah,
so walk in. We don't know how somebody else has received the gospel,
yeah,
what it means, or the intrinsics. And we're all coming to that focal point.
Well, I supposedly acknowledged that in my talking about the hermeneutical circle and us as interpreters, but you know, once in a while you have to be reflexive and think, okay, so how's that affecting how I'm teaching about the hermeneutical circle? You know, around you go.
Where does that name, the hermeneutical circle, come from? Is that your own idea, was it?
Well, hermeneutics, of course, is hermeneutes in Greek is the word for translator or interpreter. And it's used as a general term, hermeneutics, as a
sorry,
discipline.
Human.
Yeah.
Hermeneutical circle.
Yeah. The hermeneutical
circle. Is that your own diagram? I mean.
I made that up last night. That picture.
It's a book called The Hermeneutical Spiral, which refers,
yeah,
to the hermeneutical circle.
Yeah.
Ventil
speaks of the hermeneutical spiral.
Yeah.
So. So if we take our experience, sometimes with undergrads it's fun to do, if we take our experience of knowing God, it is circular, and we go around and around the circle in our knowledge of God, which forms a complete system. It's best if you have a slinky. You have that?
Yeah.
So if you lay it down on the, it only works overhead. It doesn't work anymore now. It's a circle, and then you pick it up and you stretch it out and say, but at each rotation you're advancing in your understanding. You add that other dimension to it. And, I think that's really cool. So just imagine, you know, you're slinky then, and you stretch that out. And so, yeah, that, the hermeneutical spiral is. I think I've seen it in Mantel somewhere.
You just invented a new word, the hermeneutical
slinky. Does Dantzel refer to the slinky?
He doesn't refer to the slinky. No, I have to take credit for the slinky as the
Jason slinky.
Listen, we've reached 12:30, which is our every time. Jason, are there one more question that anyone needs to ask? Otherwise, I think I'll go.
You can always send me an email. My email will remain the same, even though I'm leaving.
But Jason's leaving in 2 weeks' time.
Yeah.
So this is it. It'll be on the other side of the world. Jason, thank you.
Well, this has been enjoyable.
Thank
you.
I've really enjoyed having a chance to teach on this subject because the kind of work I do is all research, entirely research. So I don't get the opportunity to teach. So it's good that when I do get to teach, I get to teach about things in a specifically theological orientation. So that's been a pleasure.